with Provost Beverly Washington Jones in Durham, North Carolina. It is April 5th, 6th?
Today is the 5th.
5th, and we're in her office. The interviewer is Geraldine Patterson, and this is part of the Spencer Grants Project on school desegregation in the South and will be used as part of the Southern Oral History Program at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. The tape number is 40505BWJ. Okay. Dr. Jones, how did you come to be at Hillside? When did you attend?
We were the first group to actually spend, I would consider, the ninth grade at Hillside. So that probably was 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th. So graduating in 66, probably 62 or 63, going over to Hillside. We started something different, which was 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th.
And previously, ninth graders had gone to?
They had gone to either, we were at Quidditch Junior High School. Mm-hmm. And then they sort of moved us over. Your elementary was up to the sixth grade.
Okay.
I was in school.
Okay.
And then 7th, 8th, and 9th was considered to be, I assume, junior high. Mm-hmm. We didn't call it middle school.
Okay.
And then, of course, your high school was really 10, 11, and 12.
Okay. So can you tell me what you remember most about Hillside?
I think the most significant thing that I remember, and I'm going to just point out a personality that would be Prof. Austin when I think about Hillside. A school that demanded discipline, despite whether you were the child of the banker at Mutual or you were the child of the someone who taught at North Carolina Mutual Insurance Company. Everybody was disciplined, so it was nothing unusual to see honor students, if they had done anything wrong, picking up trash. So I think the signature of Hillside is that a tremendous concern with education, despite the economic background of parents. Everybody was treated as equal. I think the most second significant thing about it is that you could never say you couldn't do it. It was a really strong, motivational type of faculty that demanded excellence without any excuse whatsoever. And then again, I think the other thing is that these individuals were not afraid to communicate with the home, the parents, if need to be, as well as to visit the home. Not only if they weren't afraid to do that, is that many times the teachers and principals were from the same church. So there was a sense of community as it related to Hillside. So you could be walking down the street and your parents could run into the principal or your teacher. There were no sacred hiding places as it related to the clientele of faculty there, because they were from the community and understood that and did not decide to withdraw to go to somewhere else. They lived in the community, went to the same ABC stores, went to the same grocery stores, went to the same churches. So there was no hiding place of communication as it related to the staff there and your parents.
You've spoken a little bit about the community. Can you tell me a little bit more about what it was like to live in Durham when you went to Hillside? Was it very different from how Durham is now?
I stayed really about two blocks from Hillside, which was on Dunston Street. So there was no problem walking to Hillside, walking home. That's what you did. So you really don't see the busing type of activity, which is a part of really desegregation. It was in the community. You were close enough to it. The centrality of the community was really Hillside. The community took a lot of faith and a lot of pride in the band, which of course is legendary.
Right.
But in everything that took place at Hillside, in terms of students excelling, in terms of plays, The community was there. There were no empty seats in the auditorium if the theater group decided to perform. And it sort of represented a sense of from slavery to freedom. I think the biggest goal that African Americans had was assured that their children were educated. So even working class individuals found time for the PTA, found time to make sure that they were there when their children would be performing. So it really brought about a close knit. If you had to start a conversation, you could easily start one by saying Hillside. You didn't have to fumble if someone came in your presence. That became the dominant type of conversation in the community. A strong sense of support for school. Individuals going into their pockets, if need be, to assure that students were going to get the experiences that were necessary. And you did have some top flight students that came out of that environment. There was no such thing as a group of students not doing well. There might have been one or two, but never was there a group that was not excelling or doing well, or the behavior of individuals. You really didn't have that, some of the deep-seated issues that we find in our community. So students knew that they had to excel, and they knew that that was required. There was no negotiating on the type of culture that was created in the community that demanded that everyone knew what their responsibilities in that culture. In essence, you had a culture of excellence that was demanded not only in terms of academics, but also behavior. And the responsibility was clearly indicated. Building of character. All of those values were instilled by the faculty, also the community. So it was no problem if someone from the community saw you doing something wrong, call your parents. Your parents received it very receptively. So that was a difference in terms of culture and values.
Now, I've heard a couple of people that I've interviewed, and you just touched on that, said that students just knew and started talking about this culture of excellence. Can you say a little bit more explicitly how students just knew and how the parents and faculty in the community actually created this culture, how those expectations were communicated?
Well, I think for one thing, in a segregated environment, I think what grows out of that is even starting from the family. Despite if you were poor or in poverty, there were values, and parents instilled those values. I think there was a closer connection to the history, a closer connection to a civil rights movement, that you knew that you were going to be alienated, and despite the Jim Crowism of this time period, it really worked in essence in creating that culture. Because everyone demanded that of you, and you knew that that was something that was instilled upon you. So parents sort of instructed that, yes, you know, you're going to face these dilemmas in life, and there will be separate water fountains, and we're going to be treated separately. But the struggle is not only in terms of creating a change in terms of the attitude of that time period, is that you also have to be worthy of saying, yes, we deserve this. And your actions will speak highly of the race. So that means that at all times, you need to uphold the race. So there's a lot of race elevation and enhancement. They say we're not good enough, but you can prove it by the way you act. You can prove it through your academics. So you are not only upholding your family, but you're upholding the race at the same time. So it just became incumbent that this was to be expected. Because of, you know, the type of environment, and segregation does that to you. Discrimination does that to you. So you're constantly proving, by proving, it instills those values in it, because therefore it becomes an ethos, a way of life. And I think that everybody understood situations that we faced under Jim Crow.
So how, in the mid-60s when you were at Hillside, talk to me about Durham in terms of segregation, because I don't have a context for that. I don't have a picture of that in my head.
Well, segregation permeated Durham not only in terms of your work life and schools, but also even going to the grave.
Okay.
Economically, you did see the crossing of segregation, because even Booker T makes it very clear that you can be separate as it deals with the question of politics, but economics, you know, there is a blending here and an understanding.
Mm-hmm.
So the business community understood to a large degree how to cross those lines for economic empowerment, even though we created our own economic structure. That structure, in many times, deferred to whites to understand that we can also work together interracially on several things. Durham is a typical, the largest number of PhDs you would find in Durham or Atlanta. Mm-hmm. And I think Franklin Frazier makes it very clear, like bourgeoisie, he's talking about Durham. Mm-hmm. Durham was very different. And being different, you basically could understand that desegregation to a large degree was being practiced economically than practiced politically or socially.
Okay.
So there were separate communities, separate conclaves, but also Durham was unique too, because there was a middle and a lower class. Mm-hmm. There were working class individuals who were struggling, and many times many of the homes that individuals rented out or apartments were owned by landlords who were black, and many of them were slum landlords.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't want to give anybody the impression that black folks didn't do nothing wrong in terms of their lives, but they did. And economics many times makes you do things that you would not ordinarily do, though we believe you lift as you climb. In some areas, people lifted, but they didn't help others to climb. We had our own social institutions, North Carolina College. We had, of course, our own library, later was Stanford Warren Library. We had our own social benevolent groups, the YWCA. So we created a culture, a structure within as a means of empowerment as well as a means of survival. That empowerment to a large degree helped us to identify ourselves. So we redefined what it meant to be a black person or a Negro or an African American. It was defined by our culture, despite what segregation did. African Americans understood their identity. Creating these structures even gave a much more strong sense of identity that also brought a sense of strong community as well as empowerment.
Okay, I'm gonna get to Brown versus Board in 1954. You attended 62 through 66. Did you feel that Brown versus Board had any impact on Hillside when you were there?
Not really. I think that we continued to maintain. I know the consent decree was one that, a freedom of choice, was one that some of our students opted to go to desegregate Durham High School and things of that nature, but Hillside went on as Hillside.
Did white students come to Hillside during that time period at all?
No, there were no white students. I think that was later when white students began to come to Hillside. We were totally from a segregated school, and we maintained that and basically graduated from a desegregated school.
Did you feel like school desegregation or integration had any impact on your family at all?
I know that I'm 11. There are 11 in my family.
Siblings?
I'm the ninth in the family. So I know that one of my brothers under me did attend Durham High School, but that was during the the latter part in the 80s, and okay. the, at that time, much had been sort of settled in terms of it. I was very active in the civil rights movement. Even in high school, wanted to eat them 28 flavors at Howard Johnson and sit at the white folks' table. So extremely active with the NAACP. Knew of the Malcolm X University of Howard Fuller's name now has changed.
Okay.
But to a large degree, I think that was part of the beginning of my activism. My sisters and brothers, my older sisters and brothers, participated, and I wanted to participate too. Why not?
Mm-hmm.
So it was nothing unusual for my mother to get a call saying, you have five of your children downtown here, locked up, whatever. I think the activism basically strengthened my life to make me understand and to remember from whence I come. In many ways, my activism has been transformed into being involved in a lot of K-12 efforts in terms of closing the achievement gap or eliminating the achievement gap, which means, in essence, those who came from that truly understand what their responsibility is to the community and the role that they must play in regard to that.
Do you think there's something special that schools like Hillside did that's lost?
Well, I do. I do think it is. The whole question, I think the Brown decision made very clear, is still a lingering question today, and that question is equity. The issue of educational resources that need to be provided to all schools, and there should be no differences. And that's why Linda Brown and her family sort of became involved in this, because, you know, the school that she was attending, to a large degree, was one that many miles away, but not the resources.
Mm-hmm.
And those same issues are back today.
Mm-hmm.
We still don't have the equity that is needed for resources in reference to our schools. What that desegregated environment did was that, despite that, students were motivated and pushed to excel.
Okay.
And there are many products that will show that these students excelled and are leaders in the different professions that they're involved in. And, you know, despite it all, they didn't acquiesce.
Mm-hmm.
Even though we just may have had one microscope to be used by several students, that didn't stop the sense of eagerness to learn and to make something out of their lives. So that's what that movement did. It really forced individuals to go beyond and to excel. Now, with desegregation, many of those values that have been inculcated are sort of dissipated, and students don't really have a compass on what direction and focus that they're developing, that they're going in. And many of those values, they have become Europeanized, and they're accepting values from a different race that to a large degree has been deleterious, and a lack of understanding what that history is and that culture, which was so ingrained, would make a world of difference. It is a different generation with different values, and much of that eroded under desegregation.
What do you think the gains were from school desegregation?
I do believe in pluralism, and I believe in diversity. I think it's important that, living in a very international and global society, that individuals will need to go to school together to sort of understand, but they also have to be sort of discreet in what they accept from the majority race, which would become the minority race, because the people of color would dominate very soon, as we did before. Mm-hmm. So I think that bringing those cultures together is important, but we sort of have to instill in our children to be very, very discreet in terms of analyzing and accepting certain things and what you do not accept. I think the second thing in regard to it, it did prove that there were some whites who weren't as smart as blacks. And many times we were always given the perception that they are smarter and they're brighter because they've had exposure in terms of that. But there are some students who are African Americans that can compete, you know, directly with them. The other thing it showed too is that you did not have some teachers within that desegregated situation didn't understand African Americans, especially African American males, and began to label. They saw them as threatening. You know, believe it or not, African American males, many times you have to just be stern and to holler out to them, stop it. But you can't say, y'all need to stop, that ain't gonna work. Because living in an environment, they've been taught to be strong and to be resilient. And many times with that, it is that softness is not what they're trying to, they're used to. So they have not learned in terms of that. Also, I think the other issue is that African Americans many times have different learning styles. I think all children have different learning styles. And I think the desegregated movement was not ready to deal with students in a class of 30 with these diverse learning styles. And in many ways, our students were lost. They were caught in the gap. And as a result of that, you began to see a large number of them not excelling. Now, the other thing with that, and I have to be very pragmatic about this, is that many of them were coming out of environments that did not have the family structure that created those environment, you know, values. So I'm not placing everything on the school. I'm saying that there were some systemic issues that impacted their lives. And the understanding of those systemic issues, I don't think the schools understood to how do you deal with a young kid who's coming here who is not eating? How do you deal with a young kid whose mother didn't come home? And they're coming to shirt with, coming to school with the same shirt they wore yesterday. You know, how do you deal with that? Because they're coming from environments that they are not used to that. Okay. So they are not ready to handle a situation like this. Regrettably, they're not. But I think the desegregation movement has made it very clear to our community that the role that we played prior to desegregation, we must rekindle that role. It is our responsibility to set up Saturday academies and after-school programs and to look to our churches to say we need your support and we need to set up these programs also in the churches. That we just don't need to go there on Sunday for salvation and on Wednesday night. They need to become a part of this civil rights movement. I call what we're going through now as the second civil rights movement, the reclaiming of our children. And that role has to be a responsibility, as the other civil rights movement taught us. African Americans went to the streets. They called upon others to assist them. We must go and reclaim our children and call upon others to assist us. And the faith community must be at the vanguard of that movement, like the civil rights movement of the 60s. They must be at that vanguard. The largest number of African Americans are in church on Sunday. The message has to be delivered by those ministers. And they will listen to the minister. So we have to be a part of this counter-revolution to assure that young people like you and others, that our young people can walk in the footsteps of you one day and to be in leadership roles and to get their education and to be able to excel. But it is incumbent upon African Americans, the community, to make sure that they are playing the role that's critical and to be about the business of trying to look at this culture and instill it in it. Within any revolution or movement, you're not going to save everybody. but it is a responsibility, and we are an accomplice. Mm-hmm. We do not attempt to save some of our children. So to me, desegregation is said back to us. It is our responsibility. It is not theirs. Mm-hmm. We aren't saying that you can't participate, but you must participate on our terms. Mm-hmm. So that's what the movement is about now.
And so I'll end by asking you, what do you think makes Hillside so unique? This is kind of a broad question. What do you think makes it so unique? What do you think is important for us to learn from the legacy? When I tell people that I'm interviewing people about why Hillside is so important to alumni in this community, what sorts of things should I be telling them?
Historically, Hillside is one of, I think, the 13 Black high schools, or maybe 16 out of that. Mm-hmm. That makes it unique in its own, that it was able to withstand a movement of desegregation, which principals lost their jobs, mm-hmm. in which many of our schools that were centered for the naming of a legacy of individuals prior to them, or naming of a community, that those institutions' names were changed, mm-hmm. and schools were degraded. That makes it significant. Okay. I think the second thing that makes it significant is that it has maintained a leadership that has been African-American. Okay. Many of those schools, of course, whites came in and became principals, so that legacy has still remained, and the community itself has been intricate to remaining of the school under the leadership, as well as the naming of that mm-hmm. school. But I think the third significant thing about Hillside is that withstanding the era of Jim Crowism and the obstacles that confronted the lives of African Americans, Hillside has remained true to its community mm-hmm. and to its race, that it will bring up and nurture and educate a group of students of African Americans descent that will be able to be leaders and to be very prominent in various professions. Mm-hmm. It has maintained that. It has never in any way sort of moved from its position mm-hmm. in terms of that. So if you look at leaders that are coming out of the community, Hillside has produced the bulk of those leaders. Okay. So it's maintained dear to its mission. Is maintained to his singing of the alma mater. Mm-hmm. That has what's been sort of sustaining about that institution. Mm-hmm. And that the community has always saw it as its institution. Mm-hmm. So the lessons that we can learn from all of this is that the struggle begins every morning. The lesson that we learn from all of that is that we must be actively involved, as Hillside is, in ensuring that there will be a generation of African Americans who will be able to still move this community and to assure that all of these young people will have an opportunity.
Thank you.